Our structure is perfect. Introduce the members of the team.
Oh, that's it. No, go ahead.
If that is okay.
Go ahead.
In order.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Committee members. On behalf of the chairperson of the Board of Arms Corps, retired Admiral Mudinu, and the Deputy Chair, we would like to say thank you very much for the opportunity for Arms Corps to present this corporate plan. Both the chairperson and the Deputy Chair are sending their regards and their apologies at the same time. They are both not well. The Deputy Chair, Ambassador Skweyiya, recently had a bereavement of your former colleague, Dr. Zola Skweyiya, and she was therefore not able to travel with us. I would like to, some of the board members that are here with us and the committee and the executives may be familiar to the members of the honorable members of the committee, but I would like to do the formal introduction. Mr. Kevin Wakeford, the CEO of Arms Corps, and on my right is Dr. Kanyile, who is serving a second term in the board of Arms Corps. Next to me is Ms. Clarinda Simpson. She is a new member of the board. Mr. Krobler is the CFO of Arms Corps. Ms. Kumalo is the company secretary. And Mr. Solomon Zimbada is the group executive. And Professor Noel Mukaza is also a group executive. And we have with us Mr. Doug Fezel, who is an acting group executive. And Mr. Henry van Rensburg, who is acting at the dockyard presently. And excuse me, I mean, I live there, best for last. Ms. Kathy Nianakis, who is an executive manager at the CEO's office. And my name is Raymond Vowana, non-executive director of the board. And we'll give the platform to Mr. Wakeford, sir.
No, thank you very much. I took it for granted that we know each other. I didn't know that there are new people here. And our team from the extreme right is Honorable Mkhlongo, followed by Honorable Murray, Honorable Isau, and Mutimele. And other members will join us as we continue. Thank you very much. Over to you, CEO.
Thank you, Chair. I've taken note of the fact that you need me to move fairly quickly, so let me first start off with a verbal assessment, and then I'll take you through a few of the slides. You'll remember I started on the 1st of May 2015. The first interaction with this committee was for the annual report 2015, where we spoke to the new realities that we are facing. We are umbilically linked and inextricably dependent on the National Defence Force and their acquisition requirements and their research requirements. And up to now, we have survived as an institution or sustained ourselves on the basis of servicing the South African National Defence Force. Of course, the very same challenges that face them ipso facto face us as well. We can't deny that. So we back then started reconfiguring our operating model and our business model to meet these new realities. Part of that was to cut costs, which we've done, and I'm sure you can see that in our financials. And part of that was also to look to using the existing legislative mandate that we have. And that mandate allows us, with our complex acquisition skills and our scientific research skills, to offer those skills to the state. And as you will also know, we have in excess of 500 well-educated, highly skilled engineers and scientists who can add value in other areas within the security cluster, but also within local government, even at provincial level if need be, in a whole variety of areas where the state is wanting and where Arms Corps has the capability to assist. So as part of our new revenue streams, we have instituted various changes within the, let's call it the overall organogram and the structure of the organization to meet those new needs and to become a sustainable entity over time. One of the big issues raised in 2015 was when any organization's in trouble, whether it be the state at a national level or one department within the state, it doesn't matter, you always look to your balance sheet, to what is available on your balance sheet to sweat, to use productively, and to find ways of squeezing blood out of a stone if need be. And we looked into that and we said, based on a CSIR report that was commissioned in 2012 by the Department of Defense, that there is an extensive asset portfolio that is underutilized and that could be harnessed for the use of economic activity, no matter what it might be, in order to derive revenue to finance the defense review, in particular the equipment capabilities, but even the rejuvenation requirement within the HR environment. That was approved by the Council of Defense. It was supported by this committee. We took that and we entered into a service level agreement with the Department of Defense. During that process, we discovered that the CSIR report, was not entirely correct. They'd overstated the numbers, and eventually the total value of defense land and property within the state environment was valued at about $660 billion and not $4 trillion as was calculated by the CSIR, and they contend that apparently they had changed it, but the report given to us at the time by CLOG had not been altered or changed. But $660 billion rands worth of properties is still a lot of money and still a lot of opportunity to sweat. We then discovered that the bulk of defense properties are absolutely controlled by public works, and only 3% lie within the defense portfolio of properties. In other words, those that they can control directly. The old airbase in Cape Town is a classic point. The land right next to the new soccer stadium in Greenpoint is a case in point. The bluff in Durban is a case in point. Prime properties, even within that small 3% portfolio, which is probably valued at around 10 or 15 billion rand. But all of that is opportunity. so we are awaiting the chief log and the chief SANDF to commission certain properties for us to sweat them, and we are ready and available to do that work. You will also know you spoke to us a number of times around the value of our intellectual property and technology. since then, we've done a lot of work with the help of Professor Mkaza, who heads up our R&D division, and we've identified a whole variety of technologies that are available to sustain the Defence Force, but we would need to trade with those technologies, to license them to friendly nations, to collaborate with the private sector in order to derive significant revenue. National Treasury, our CFO, Mr. Hobler, wrote to National Treasury, requested that we retain income for those purposes from sweating and commercializing IP, and the response was, sorry, that's on the balance sheet of the DOD, and you will need to send that money back to the DOD, and the DOD must send it back to National Treasury. So we have worked out legally that if the department transferred their IP assets to the Arms Corp balance sheet as a Schedule 2 company, we probably, in a few years' time, wouldn't even need a transfer from defense, if that were to be possible, given the huge opportunity, and we understand that market, we know it well, and we know what it's worth. But these are all things that can be done to fund the defense review, not only Arms Corp. But we need to be somebody to take off our handcuffs so we can be true patriots, economic patriots, and work for the state and make these things possible. So to cut a long story short, honorable members, it has not been an easy walk. But even during that walk, we have contained our costs. We'll balance our books this year. We're not going to dig into our reserves any further. We haven't had any additional budget added to our transfer. We haven't asked for additional budget. We have some challenges, which include the dockyard. And just on that matter, just to quickly brief you on the dockyard, what has happened there is that the Defense Review recommended that it be transferred to Donell. And we, as good citizens, made a lot of effort to make that possible. And during that time, perhaps we took our eye off the ball, and because the dockyard was going to be transferred, we didn't really put the effort and energy that we could have into the dockyard. So it's running at a $30 million deficit. The Navy should fill that gap, but they can't. They don't have the budget. So what are we doing? We have Henty Janssen van Rensburg. Henty, stand up, please. Henty is the new acting head of the dockyard. He's already on top of things, I must tell you, Mr. Chair. He's uncovered a whole lot of things where we can save money and where we can bring in money, and we can collaborate with South African indigenous companies that have boat building requirements and they need space. So we're going to allow them into the dockyard, and we're going to build those boats with them, and hopefully that will fill the gap and bring in even more money. So that's his mandate, and we really believe it's possible. The dockyard, it's not rocket science. We can sort it out, and we're going to sort it out. In terms of our general mandate going forward, we will still service the Defense Force to the best of our ability. You will know that the SDA account is shrinking. And by the way, it's not an account. I know everyone talks about an account. Every time money comes from the SDA, it's just a new government bond and a new set of credit measures in order to fund a new acquisition. There could be big, big constraints for us. For instance, the Hoofaster program, we know over the next year will probably not deliver much. So the Defense Force have moved that money sideways in order to give Donell some space to catch up. The industry in general is an industry in crisis. Now, the defense industry should be the flagship of our industrialization program in South Africa, but it's not. In fact, it's probably the industry in most trouble. It reminds one of what happened to the textile and clothing sectors in the 1990s, where whole factories collapsed wholesale. The very same thing is happening to our industry. And it's happening for a variety of reasons. The one being that there is a shrinkage in domestic spending on defense. The other is that Donell, for whatever reason, is in big trouble. You are well aware of that. We've spoken about this. You asked me questions in the last session about this. Donell's in trouble. But Donell holds some of the most strategic and sovereign capabilities, in particular in the missile arena and in the artillery arena. The rest, vehicles and that type of thing, we can source from other indigenous companies. But in those two areas, we are most vulnerable as the state. And you also know it's got some of the best brains in technology in the country. The defense sector is inextricably linked to who we are as Arms Corps. And without a vibrant, innovative defense sector, we're in big trouble, not only as a defense sector, but as a country. Why? Because the economic multipliers are very high. they are multipliers that cause massive economic growth if properly marshaled and managed, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have a situation where the level, the quality of work in defense, the quality of the jobs created are the best in the world. And if you lose those people and those jobs, you lose them to other countries. At the moment, a lot of our people are immigrating to the Middle East. Defense engineers, missile scientists, you name it. Why are they going there? Because they don't see a future in our defense sector. And they see the economic trouble brewing on the horizon. They're not foolish. They know what's going on. So it's a sector that can be salvaged. It can be rescued. But it requires a collaborative and team effort from all concerned, from the National Defense Force, from the Department of Defense, from the different defense services, from the National Treasury, from public enterprises, from the Commander-in-Chief. Everyone needs to get together to say, do we want a defense sector? And if so, what are we going to do to salvage it? We will survive as an organization. Why? Because we are selling our services to other African countries. We're selling our services to other government departments. We will balance our books in this coming financial year. In the last year, currently we're looking at a 6.5 million rand loss, which is very small. But in fact, this lady next to me has collected 300 million in outstanding rentals. And that 300 million, we can't put on our balance sheet yet because it's got to come from the Public Works Department. So we are just awaiting that payment. And then, in fact, we will have a 300 million surplus for the last financial year. So we are even checking debtors and collection of money. We are doing everything efficiently as we can do it in order to sustain Arms Corps. Why do we need to sustain Arms Corps in the midst of a whole variety of felt fires all around us? We need to sustain Arms Corps because it's the brains trust of the country. Arms Corps has 1,000 people at head office who are they are some of the best skilled and educated people in our country. They're engineers and scientists, and they know how to put a plan together and implement it. And that's what our country needs. And they're not, I know there's a perception that Arms Corps is lily white. It's not. You'll see, if you read my plan, the current figures, we now close to the national balance in terms of white versus black and colored versus Indian and woman versus men and all those things. We've been, under Salomzi and Bada, we've done our work. We've rebalanced Arms Corps. So we are truly non-racial organization. We're not a gerontocracy anymore. We're not ruled by the aged. I'm probably the oldest person there, and I'm 56. Even my board's younger than me, you know. So we're getting places, we're moving, and we are doing things progressively. But we can't do it alone. We need to work as a team. And we can make a big difference in sweating land assets, IP assets. We can even put together a rescue package for our industry, and we can implement it. But we can't do it if just one link in the chain decides that it's a bad idea. Then everything collapses. So my team is motivated, they're committed, they haven't gone to the begging bowl to the Department of Defense for more money. They've said, we'll live with what we get. And we had a huge cut 3 years ago. It was, I think, 389 million in our normal transfer. Yeah. So our total budget with all our income, not just from defense, is around 1.4. We employ close to 1,500 people. Yes, the dockyard numbers have gone up, Honorable Issa, but it's gone up because the Department of Defense, 30 years ago, appointed those people as fixed-term contractors. And we decided the ethical and moral thing to do, a lot of them are close to retirement,
is to put them on our permanent payroll because they do a permanent job, and to allow them to leave the defense environment in dignity. They've been treated as labor brokers and labor broker employees for the last 30 years, and we've decided to change that in terms of what is required of us from the state. The state speaks about labor brokers, it speaks about contract workers, etc., etc. All of those people are now on the Armed Corps payroll. And we are using them, and in fact the dockyard could grow if we bring in the work we expect to bring in. We could have more employees, but we're going to use those employees efficiently. There's going to be no time to sit in the sun, only over work tea time and perhaps lunchtime. But otherwise, we are going to work. So, Chair, I could go through this whole thing, but I don't think it's necessary. If you want me to go through any particular slide, any particular category, I'll happily do that. But I feel that we should rather engage in dialogue. If you have specific questions, we can deal with those questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, CEO. I guess members have gone through the documents and they could ask questions. Then we'll take questions from members and comments. Honorable Murray, Honorable Sal, you follow.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wexford. Much appreciated. Can I start off by, I think you will appreciate that we more than often play devil's advocate, because that's the way that we confront things and obviously you get the opportunity to respond. After we have listened this morning, and after we have listened now, I've listened to you, I ask myself as a devil's advocate, so what is the relevance of Arms Corps? Because quite clearly, if the budget is under constraint with the DOD, that obviously impacts on what they can afford appropriating to you now and in the future, and there's no guarantees for the future. You quite rightly said that our defense industry is bleeding, and then one eventually says, okay, now, can we do without Arms Corps? So what's the relevance of Arms Corps with regards to all those, because you might get people say, you know, move those functions into either Donnell or move it to the Department of Defense. So why do we need a separate Arms Corps? Because obviously it's a structure, and you know, in a time like this, one must really go and back to basics, cut those unnecessary stuff. The only things that must get priority is the non-negotiables. And I think there it is very important to try to find out, because you are vulnerable, as the others similarly. So obviously, and we appreciate the fact that you must justify your own existence and your own role. But one must really ask, you know, what is the relevance, and especially with 1,000 people and with all the scientists, and they, somebody can say, shift them to the CSIRI, you know, hypothetically. I'm not saying it's the right thing, I'm not necessarily supporting it. So if you can elaborate on that, in terms of the relevance. In terms of other stuff, you remember last time you mentioned to us some of the problems with Donnell is the requirement to you to release guarantees. Has that proceeded? What is the situation there? So, you know, what is the, because that can also make you incredibly vulnerable, and then the defense force as well. So you need to talk about that. Then just about the basic stuff, and I wanted to interject now when you say, you know, you don't sit in the sun. I wanted to say, except for attending the jazz festival. So obviously things like that is important for me to know. One pick up these things about people flying down, attending the jazz festival, and I say, hey, what's the value for Donnell, for Arms Corps in attending the jazz festival? Could that money been used otherwise better? Similarly to, I think it's your marketing person that is currently in the USA or on their way, so you know about that. So, you know, what is that? What is her purpose in traveling? Because again, it's a couple of $100,000, the cost of flying there. What do you want to achieve? is it really going around and trying to, you know, market yourself in terms of a nice image? I want to say at the end of the day, so what? What does it mean? What does it contribute? And more than often, we sit in an unfortunate situation of looking at the immediate situation in the medium term. So not about over 10 years and 20 years, what can be done, that's fantastic. We need to have a short-term, medium-term, long-term objectives. But sometimes you are driven by the realities over the medium term. And obviously in terms of the total defense budget, we must go and sit and say how they are divided up and allocated. Does it make sense? Or is there a better way we can use that scarce resource, those funds? So if you can talk about that, then just on the budget that you've indicated, if you can also give us an indication of what it was last year, going forward, and then specifically your increases, are you working on a specific index? Because you're not working with a basket of food. Again, I said what I said this morning, don't tell me you work on CPI. I'll laugh at you. Because that's not relevant to your industry and the cost structures of your industry. So let's be honest about those things. Because that can also, you know, can look very, paper is very patient. You can put anything on paper. But reality is totally a different story. Then, on the IPVs and the OPVs of the dockyard, we know that we are in dire need of that. We know that the president has just signed the commitment for Operation Copper, the extension, and it was indicated that there will be four vessels of the Navy. Now we know that most of the times there's not even four operational. So how the hell are we going to use four? My expectation was that, hey, this new ones is coming up, we're going to use them. But it doesn't look like that for the next year. So that's a major challenge to us, and we want to know, you know, what is happening there. Then on other assets, we know the budget constraints, but we've been now in the DRC. We've experienced and seen firsthand the challenges with equipment and operational equipment like helicopters, like vehicles, even the C-130. And the chairperson will tell you that we are very adamant about that, that our troops must use commercial airlines to fly back to South Africa at exorbitant cost, because this one C-130 that is flying there when there's no technical problems is not reliable. So it means that, and also the turnaround times of spare parts, of replenishments, everything is reliant on that those aircraft. We do not have that, and we know the problem is how do we buy that at this economic times. What are the options for us to look at 35 Squadron that must do the marine border patrols, and to add maybe that as an assistant to Ops Copper, and then specifically our, so that's 35 Squadron, but then also 28 Squadron. We know that there's nothing basically going on purely because of the equipment. What recommendations can you make to come us and say, listen, guys, we know that there's budget constraints. We know that even the SDA, as you refer to it, has been cut. We used the money even for salaries. We know that last year, R1 billion was moved to for human resource costs. What can be done in the best interest of complying with Section 200 of the Constitution? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I must make you aware, honorable members, that we must end this engagement with the Arms Corps at 3 o'clock so that we can work.
Honorable Chair, I'll say you that I've got 12 questions without putting the writing to Arms Corps. That will save us time. I'll just ask maybe two or three questions, that's all. The one is the loss that is suffered, the deficit of 30.6 million on the dockyard. Is that planned only for this year because of the intervention by Arms Corps and appointing of Mr. Inkey to actually do the necessary so that a new plan can be implemented and that we can at least break even and not have a further loss next year? The other one is the severance packages that were given to 29 people. Are there further packages also being offered next year to people? I do understand that you want to reduce maybe staff, but it must not be at the expense of critical skills that are being lost. If we can be appeased of that, please go ahead. I think the last one is the performance on strategic defense acquisition contracts. Before you managed to do it in 111 days, now you pitched it at 270 days. Can we have maybe an up in the performance to improve on that one? Thank you very much. Other questions I'll put in writing. Thank you very much.
No. Very briefly, very, very much, Mr. Wigwad. I think you actually alleviated my asthma a bit. Now, what I wanted to find out from you, sir, is you actually mentioned that for defense review process, AMSCO can be able to actually do some kind of jump-starting in that particular area. I think, Chairperson, this morning we had the presentation that DOD is saying that they can't actually then action that. I'll request that maybe Mr. Wigwad would have to advise us as to what can be done in order to be able to get that defense review up in zone. Because without it, Chairperson, the defense will be walking the way that it does not know where it is going to without that review process being finalized. If then AMSCO is actually saying that they can come to the rescue in one way or the other, let us actually then get some more information and see how can we take that process forward. Then two is the question of the type of assistance that you need. Because the issues that you raised to me are issues that actually then bring or rekindle the element of lost hope that we had this morning. What type of assistance so that we can actually be able to get the process as lawmakers come to the rescue of AMSCO so that whatever lacuna that exists can be broken through various interventions that will be made by us through the process of Parliament. If you can then come up what type of assistance that is required so that through you, Chairperson, that kind of assistance will have to be made to the disposal of AMSCO in order to come to the rescue of this particular thing. Then lastly is the question, sir, to say, in the acquisition of the covets that were acquired by this country sometimes back, something key there was the acquisition of intellectual property rights, because the aim was to actually lift our defense capabilities to world class. What has happened? I'm raising this, Chairperson, because, you know, I spend a lot of time in the Portfolio Committee of Police. You know that recently FDA nearly committed a kind of a coup d'etat in this country, whereby our own technology is controlled by people who are unpatriotic to the country. Now, if and only if people then bring such a risk to the country, when we have got capabilities, in-house capabilities, of which the Department of South African Police can actually then, through the budget allocated by the state, can actually put to the service of such organs like AMSCO or DENEL, in order to acquire those things in a much more protected way, instead of it actually dumping it to people like FDA that are even saying that we can actually then hang you, even only if you don't brush our back, despite our illegalities that we are committing. That thing is suicidal, Chairperson. I am then saying, what can be done so that we can actually, as lawmakers, begin to intervene and say, because what this division of AMSCO is doing to me is exactly what we want, to actually ensure that we get some kind of recapitalization that will create jobs instead of state organs being backers like what we have seen with SAA and all that, being non-sustainable and all that. So what is it that needs to be done? Failure to do that, Chairperson, it will be failure on our party's public representative in our judges. Thank you.
Over to you, Mr. Wakeford.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the relevance of OMSCO, I think it's never been more relevant than it is now. Let's go back in history. Why was OMSCO formed? OMSCO was formed to deal with the lack of ability to import military equipment at that time. There was a sanctions regime in place, so it became an import substitution process of industrialization. And this country needs industrialization more than it's ever needed it before, because industry creates jobs. Even if you look at our acquisition process, let me just take you to it quickly. Where is it now? It's still back. Sorry about this. But it's important. I want to show it to you. Okay, while Kathy's looking for a chair, you can see who's in charge, eh? They call her Mrs. Trump. That GE there at the end of the row calls her Mrs. Trump. A lot of the work we do at Danel, actually, this is just the history. It's not the through life cycle management program. But the through life cycle management program, Chair, has technology development, IP. Then you go to testing that development with your demonstrators. Remember, this is complex equipment with weapon systems, with, you know, vehicles that can go over sand dunes and drive through jungles and mud. It's quite unbelievable what this country has produced up to as recently as last year. Then, once you've proven the development phase, then you've got to go into the industrialization phase and set up production lines and train people to do that work. And those are high-level jobs. Those are engineers on those production lines. Young engineers, young black ladies, some of them, who have just got out of varsity but who've had the stomach to go overseas. And we've got two youngsters that have just come back from Russia. They're aeronautical engineers. People coming back from the UK, the US, all over. Well equipped. Once you've industrialized, then you go into production. And you produce 200 units of special purpose vehicles, whatever they may be. It's a long process. And if you want to develop industry, that's the process you've got to go through. You can't develop an industry without going through that process. So you've got to train your people. We train 174 bursars every year, together with defense. 174 youngsters going through science and maths, engineering, the whole two. I've got more masters, MSCs, than probably most institutions. These are people who add value to the country. Now, if we're going to rebuild our defense sector, we need Arms Corps to do that. Because you can't do complex acquisition with a purchasing manager. You're gonna get rubbish. Or you're just going to import from other countries and do it military off the shelf or civilian off the shelf. No jobs. So, in my view, we're the only institution in South Africa that has the capability through supply chain and through acquisition to actually develop economic activity that makes sense. Because you don't want to import military equipment. The moment you start importing military equipment, you then push your costs up through your through life cycle management, and you've got no control over that equipment. You have foreign engineers working on it, There's always going to be a breach of security. If you build it yourself, you know how it works, you've got people trained to use it, and you research that in terms of innovation and adding to it over time. At the moment, we've got people working on a mortar that operates out of a vehicle. It's unbelievable. And that thing moves around, and you can shoot accurately with it. So there's a lot of this type of thing. Let me give you an example. MBDA came to see me from France. We placed an order on them for naval missiles. They said, no, man, this is a small order. 300 units. Our production line is too expensive. What did I say to them? I said, listen here. With this order and all the dip credits that you owe us, why don't you come and set up a factory here? Guess what? They're very excited. So we exhaust the DIP credits that they owe us, and they owe us a lot. Defense Industry Program credits, number one. Number two, they bring that capability to this country, team up with indigenous players, and it doesn't have to be Dunel. They were told by somebody years ago they had to deal with Dunel. They can deal with anyone, because we regulate IP through who? Through Professor Mkhaza. We now enter into IP framework agreements, answering your question, Honourable Member, where we regulate, we own the IP, they produce, they can exploit it, they pay us a royalty, and they don't do anything without our consent. That's how we manage intellectual property. In the past, everything had to go to Dunel. But if you put everything in one basket and something goes wrong, you've got a problem. So now, We partner with industry across the board, but they must be indigenous. And if they're foreign, they must come and invest here. Like Saab Grintech, they had to come and invest in order to partner us on certain technologies. GEW, on electronic warfare, the same thing. They must partner us, they must sign an IP framework agreement, and we do business. So, the Honourable Member, Marais, the relevance of Arms Corps has never been more relevant. Secondly, Dunel guarantees, when they had space on their balance sheet in 2015, the board allowed them to convert the performance guarantee into a corporate guarantee off their balance sheet, because their balance sheet had some space. By 2016, December, they had no space on their balance sheet. They wanted to release another performance guarantee, a few hundred million. We said, we'll release it if you insure it. They went to Godrus, they got an insurance package, and we released it. So if they don't perform, at least we can call in that guarantee. We've done all we can. We pay them within 7 days. But they can't pay our suppliers now, the subcontractors. And those companies are now in trouble. And we've got to find a way to save them. Once again, Arms Corps can assist. So what are we doing now? On some contracts, with Dunel's concurrence, we are paying subcontractors directly. Directly. In order to save jobs and to save companies. On the jazz festival, Honourable Marais, I've never been to a jazz festival. I'm not a jazz lover. But we have a lot of people who can do business with us that are jazz lovers. We sent two members only from Arms Corps to the jazz festival, and we did invite some guests from potential client sectors. And we met them. They lived, most of them were down here for whatever reason. So we didn't have to fly them down or anything like that. But people from COCTA, as an example, where we are dealing with local government and trying to assist as Arms Corps on water reticulation programs, complex acquisition, etc. So we took a number of people from Robben Island. We're hoping to service their boats there and to do their disposals on those boats. So there were people as part of that, and we didn't pay hundreds of thousands. It was just in excess of 100,000 rand. And in terms of our total budget, my belief was it was money well spent, because good connections were made there. Lulu Mzili's trip at the moment to New York, she's with Ambassador Ndlovu, one of our board members, Sipho Mkhwanazi, head of acquisition. The three of them have gone to see the UN Peacekeeping Procurement Secretariat to see if Arms Corps can engage and assist in terms of UN activities on the African continent, in terms of assessing capability design for
for them to see whether they want to work with a particular nation, but also in terms of some of their direct requirements. They procure and they spend a lot of money on the continent, in excess of 80 billion rand per annum, and quite a bit of that is for supplies and things like that. So we can justify that trip to New York without even blinking. It's going to bring in, I think, good return on investment. what is the budget now, and what was it? Gerrit, if you could just respond to that, please.
Chair, maybe just to add, just to respond to that, I think the budget moved to 7.3% in terms of total cost. It moves from 1.49 billion to 1.6 billion. But that, you must also look at revenue that increased with more than 6%. You must also then remember that the biggest portion of our cost is salary-based cost, which then is affected by salary negotiations. And I mean, we budget accordingly, according to what is the expected outcome of that negotiation process. So that is the biggest portion. The rest are being, we are also guided by Treasury in terms of certain cost guidelines, what increases they see we should stay with. And then it's just in terms of affordability. So, I mean, it's not open-ended, it's not really CPI always, it depends on what is the actual implications for the organization as well.
Thank you. In terms of our, you're quite right, we don't work with CPI, because I think CPI maybe applies to cooking oil and maize meal, but even those are all dollar-denominated commodities, so if the rand collapses, people could end up paying 5, 6, 10 times more for a kilo of maize meal. So it's our environment is more dependent, fortunately, on indigenous business. So the currency environment isn't as, we're not as vulnerable as we were, say, 10 years ago. We've also hedged our foreign purchase book. So we've protected ourselves against big fluctuations in currency, and we're doing it for the SDA as well. So that we're dealing with. Our cost, we've got a cost determination model. We use different benchmarks. For instance, we use CIFSA on labor rates in the engineering environment. We use the CSIR benchmark in more of the scientific environment. So we are benchmarking our cost determination model on single sourcing, particularly where there is an OE involved, where we've got to use the OE. We make damn sure. I've got a negotiation tomorrow with a big electronics company because their increase from last year to this year is 60%. And we're saying to them, you've got to unpack this for us. You know, Darby, do you want to just add anything to that?
On the single source issue, we try and avoid single source situations, but there are many cases where we have to contract the OEMs, and we go through a very rigorous process to ensure that we get best value for money on all of those contracts that we place. Where we, in this case, the CEO was referring to, we actually send our audit team in to audit the cost structure of those companies to make sure that those costs are. Can all be explained, are all within the limits, and that we get this value for money.
Thank you, Darby. On the IPVs have been contracted. The 30% deposit has been paid. The company that are manufacturing the IPVs domestically is a company called Damen South Africa. It's partially owned by the Dutch. They're doing the IPVs, and they're doing it at their own dockyard. But they are considering passing on some of that work to our dockyard as well, particularly some of the the paint blasting, painting. We're busy negotiating to see what can be subcontracted to our dockyard. In terms of the hydrographic vessel in Durban, that's been contracted. The 30% deposit has been paid. Both deposits have been guaranteed. In other words, we have secured that through insurance instruments to make sure if they don't deliver, we can call in those guarantees. In terms of not meeting their milestones, there's quite a stringent penalty regime in place, but we believe they're both going to deliver. We're pushing hard. On the OPVs, you know that we linked that to the dockyard, hoping to sustain Denel as they take over the dockyard as the primary contractor on that, as per request from the Council on Defence, That obviously has fallen through now, and we are waiting further instruction from Defence Material on the OPVs. But they believe they have the budget for it. They want it contracted by the end of this financial year. So the OPVs, which will be the workhorse of the Navy, much cheaper than the corvettes and the frigates and things in terms of operations, but also big enough to go all the way up past the Malagasy coast, Mozambique, etc., for anti-piracy measures, etc. So that project will happen. There's no reason for it not to happen. No one's informed us that it's been taken off the SDA budget. In terms of what are the other measures if we run out of money? Well, you know, there are different financial instruments one can use. Besides sweating assets, etc., and filling the pot, one can also look at stretching out a budget through, like we did with the SDPs, where you go into leasing contracts or credit facilities and buy a system of systems and get everything done and then pay it off over a period of, say, 10 years. and that would also mean we could spend our annual capital budget without any challenge or constraint. Our capital budget for this year, for this last financial year, we only procured $6.5 billion versus well in excess of $10 billion, which was budgeted for, because in the main, Donnell couldn't deliver and we couldn't pay them, because we can only pay on milestones. So that set us back in terms of our own performance. If we were on a different type of program in terms of credit facilities or leasing options, we could have spent everything. Turnaround times of equipment, 28 Squadron, 35 Squadron, Davi.
We have 3 minutes.
3 minutes? Davi, 1 minute for you.
We have three goals with regards to turnaround times, one being for procurement items, which are normal items where we get to buy or replenish something which is already existing, which is already qualified. So it's simply a procurement item. Then we have a different time for maintenance and repair contracts. And then the one which was mentioned is for SDA. Our goal for SDA contracts, from time when the requirement comes to Arms Corps to the time when it is contracted, our goal is 217 days. In the 16-17 financial year, we achieved 111 days. This is measured very differently from normal procurement items, because this measures the entire acquisition process from when it is received by Arms Corps, where we have to go through all the studies, looking at different options, looking at the least risk option, the best value for money option, and then get to the point of contracting, and then follow the normal contracting process. So our achievement in the 16-17 financial year was 111 days, and this is very much dependent on the nature of the projects. Some of those projects, for example, if we were to redo the Rupaster project, would take us approximately 2 years because of the number of studies which has to be done to do the source selection process. So with regards to the utilization of 21 and 35 Squadron for maritime patrol, one of the Air Force requirements is for a maritime patrol aircraft, a new maritime patrol aircraft. The problem is that at the moment the Dakotas, which are serving as maritime patrol aircraft, are all grounded, and Arms Corps' role in this is to ensure that those Dakota aircraft become operational again. So we are negotiating with the Air Force virtually on a weekly basis to ensure that those aircraft can come back into service and can resume their role as maritime patrol aircraft to assist the Navy with the patrols that is being done by the frigate at the moment.
Just on the severance packages, and I'll end off there, the $31 million on the dockyard, we're hoping to fill that gap. So we may, in fact, not even have a deficit this year on the dockyard. On the severance packages, all the packages were early retirement packages. There were people in excess of 55, so I could have applied as well. they were people who had passed on their skill. There was a capability retention program, and it was voluntary. What we paid them, we actually are saving over a 3 year period. So even based on refilling the post with a lighter weight, a younger person, they don't cost as much, and in some cases we felt we didn't even need to fill those posts, but we reallocated work to people with broader shoulders. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
And
With that note, we will take the next presentation from CCB. You may take leave of. The written questions will be submitted. Yeah.
Gentlemen, this is the man you need to speak to about.
Unfortunately, I left them in the car. The first thing we needed to do was to, when I took over, to find out where is our IP, who's exploiting our IP, what controls do we have. So we then established a regime and the process that needed to be followed for anybody who is duly funded or co-funded IP. There was a resistance, I'm not going to lie, but now we've got some stability. And then the DOD has instructed me then to come up with what we call the framework agreement. The framework agreement talks on sovereign IP, strategic IP, it also talks about bringing black people to participate in the generation of the IP. So we're quite comfortable. That's where we are. You know IP is gold.
Without IP,
it was speaking to the issues we are raising, issues of patriotism. Because people were just taking things that were developed, and then you see them popping up in Sweden, popping up.
I know your presentation is always very short and straight to the point. Yeah, can we have your attention? Honorable members, where are my honorable members? Let's get the presentation to Calvin. Okay. You coming for? You always come. Do we know it? Okay. Oh. Okay. you can go on.
Person, thank you. Of the Portfolio Committee and members of the Portfolio Committee, my name is Audrey Achenbach. I'm appointed by the Minister of Defence and Military Veterans in one of the, I'm a CCB member, and our team here today is Colonel Fairney. He's the Officer Commanding of the Army Support Base Western Cape, and of course the CEO, Mr. Calvin Gilfillan, and he'll introduce his team afterwards. Thank you for the opportunity for us to present our APP for 2018 to you. And then furthermore, Lieutenant General Mbuli, our chairperson, requested that we apologize on his behalf. He's currently at the Chief SANDF work session in Nabum Spruit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think this is my seventh appearance in front of this committee. And I was looking so forward to a whole bench of people to give my inputs. My team with me, is it your right now? Let me start there. Doreen Hendricks, who's the marketing manager, you've met her last in October when we presented, but you haven't met Faith Ntabati, who is the events manager. and you haven't met Azolam Kozana, who is the Heritage and Education and Cultural Manager, and you've met the CFO, Mr. Manjange, who's behind me. If I've left anybody out, no, I haven't. I'll be very brief, chairperson, because I want to just convey what the board chairperson was asking me to carry over to this committee. In the light of developments, the chairperson is very clear that a clean audit, like the past two, is a non-negotiable, and under his leadership and the chairperson of the audit committee, who's also apologized, he's overseas, or he's... No, he's in Gauteng, so that's not really overseas, chairperson, sorry about that. That we, on a firm basis of clean audit and good administration, make sure that the Castle of Good Hope is promoted as the imminent heritage site in the country. Then, on the issue of the fragmented nature of people on site, I think the chairperson is just saying that he's giving it a high priority. He's already briefed the minister about that, because there's no way that we can ask for additional resources, but the people who are sharing the site with us are parasitic, not parasitic in a bad way, but that they are extracting from the site, but they're not contributing to the site in either in kind or in other resources. So that's a very important point that the chairperson wants me to convey here. Then the other issue of the interaction of the general public with the site, it's much more than a museum. It is every interaction, whether it is from the choir, the Malay choir, or an, like last Saturday when we had the Ramadan festival, mostly Muslim community there, every interaction is meaningful, and it is delivered in a very sensitive way, because it is a contested site, like the Rose Monument, like the Fort Ricker Monument, it is a contested site, and I think in our curatorial approach is that we take heed of that, and in our presentation and in the interpretation of the site and in communicating with our stakeholders, it's important that we get that message out, not nationally, but also internationally. Then in terms of partnerships, and it's important that we recognize who our partners are, and that we, in this year, in our APP, also strive to strengthen and to galvanize those relationships. Then, of course, the importance of our relationship with statutes. There are three lawmakers in this room, so I think we need your support in ensuring that the amendments that we make to our legislation is not only supporting the organization, but is also taking the Castle of Good Hope on the international arena, any other national arena, to take it to fulfill its rightful place. And we are engaged, the AG also, in that regard. I won't elaborate on that. In my later on, I will speak about that again. But at the beginning of the year, the legislative team of the Department of Defense approached us to provide an input, because there's an overall review of all defense-related legislation. And they've asked us for our inputs. We've given those inputs. So again, I appeal to you as the legislators to just also give your impetus to that process. Because we've done what we could. You've seen in our APP, we've made our inputs. But I think it's now up to the legislators to ensure that process is unfolding, and that whatever comes out of that is done in a manner that respects not only the site as the oldest colonial building, but also all the stakeholders with a very, very vested interest in there, sometimes expressed very emotionally when we interact with them. Just then I will briefly update you on the risks, chairperson, the preventative maintenance cost. This issue came up from various departments. I remember when we left the meeting in October last year, it's about the 23rd of October, there was a slide, my penultimate slide before the questions, where I was asked what are my requirements, what do I request this committee, and one of the requirements is to support our bid for this 4.5 million sea lock support, to ensure that we look at the broken windows, look at the sewage system, let all of that, and I'm up to date, chairperson, that whole strategic risk has been managed both by the lady who sits next to me, who sits in Sea Lock, immovable property, but also a deployed major that's looking after the judicious procurement of that 4.5 million, which of course is not a transfer to the CCB, not a subsidy to the CCB, but an item, a line item in the bigger, how many billion rands? 40 billion rands CLOC budget. So that one is mitigated, Chairperson, to our satisfaction. The risk issue, and I have to, on my left-hand side, Colonel Fairley, I must say, in our last board meeting on the 8th of December last year, where the General Mbuli was very clear in his, we don't talk about destruction in our environment, but to his instruction to Colonel Fairley that this issue must be managed. And I must say, there were minimal incidents over the festive season, up till now, touch wood, basically because the way that Colonel Fairley and Staff Sergeant Williams is dealing with this issue is really, you know, controlling this. And if we get the additional CCTV cameras and the biometric access system, then I think the broader threat of criminality and petty theft will also be mitigated. So I'm also happy with this one, Chairperson and members. Then about the reputational risk, I think we can scrap this thing. You know, this was out of that incident where a radio station phoned about a drunk member of SNDF that was confronting a New Zealand tourist. Now, I think this has also been managed by our external communications, but also by the previous risks that I've elaborated on. Then the management fragmentation, I've spoken about that, so I won't go into that. Then the financial sustainability. I think in this room, we were doing the calculation. We're talking about a 10 million per annum organization, and our own revenue is in the region of 5.5 to 6 million, the 4.5 of CLOC. Then we are, in fact, self-sustainable in terms of our operational plan and about our legal mandate, unless that legal mandate is radically changed by the legislative review. And there I have listed you. The unaudited figures in red at the bottom, Mandla, the CFO must help me out, is just over 5 million. So I think in terms of, if you add that to the 4.5, then we are more or less there in terms of ensuring that that our books are balancing, Chairperson, in terms of own revenue, the lock support, and the annual expenses, our expenses. I'm not going to go into this because I think that this document has been in your possession for quite some time. I have pulled out the most important issues. If you look at the middle column there, you will see that there is a decline in our total expenses and in our revenue, obviously, because in the previous years we had to factor in the surplus. But now that we've almost expended the surplus, that expenditure and revenue item will obviously come down accordingly, Chairperson. That is just some further detail, some more detail, and these are the programmatic activities. I also take that as read. I think there was a question last year around the number of interns that we dropped down from 30 to 15. We can answer that. It didn't make sense to both the interns and to management and from a financial point of view to keep it at that. We have discussed it with National Treasury. In the next MTSF medium-term strategic framework that is due after this next year, we will make that adjustment. And also in the new medium-term expenditure framework, we will make that and other minor adjustments, Chair. Just some of the events I'll quickly browse you through. Since the beginning of the year, some military event, you know, the police briefing, what is the Brigadier Pathlane? Briefing before Sona was also at the castle. The Khoisan Heritage walk is also ended at the castle on the 1st of March. Easter Monday, we had a big press, interfaith prayer service attended by over 1,000 people with Khoisan, Malay people from all the denominations on Easter Monday. I couldn't make it, Chairperson, but I understand it was quite an emotional affair. Then we had, on the 12th of April, we had an event for Mama Winnie Madikizela Mandela at the castle. It was not well attended, but well covered in the media. We also had a treasure hunt on the 21st of April. We had the District 6 land claims press conference on the 26th of April there. We had the COSATU and Broad General Workers May Day festivities. It looks like there were workers, but it was actually my steps, and all the workers would bring their children there. So there were a picnic on the lawn, and the workers, the mamas and papas will march, and they will come back and spend time with their kiddies also at the event. Then the last one was this weekend, the Ramadan for All exhibition, which was well attended. We're waiting for the web ticket feedback, but we probably close to 30,000 people over the 3.5-4-day period would have attended this exhibition. And over this weekend, on Mother's Day, we will have the slave route challenge also coming through the castle. So it's been busy and almost business as usual, Chairperson. So the required, what we required from this esteemed committee and the members is to note and accept the CCB's 2018-19 ABP with a budget update with all the risks, with all the mitigation measures. And thank you, Chairperson. I've tried to contain myself in my time. Right,
as usual. By the way, what is the total budget this financial year?
7.85 million, Chairperson. Marketing managers.
You suspect something. Any comments?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think the fundamental question regarding the council is a sustainability issue. However, the APP in the report outlet, it speaks about the recent annual 4.5 million subsidy. In the presentation now done by the CEO, it says it is not, it's an earmarked amount. In the APP of the DOD, which was presented this morning, it says at the last page, on the last item, that the castle is self-sustaining. And there's no indication of money being transferred, except those that are seconded from the Defense Force that served there. So there's no clarity, there's a misconception that it is not, and yet it is reported in the APP on a few places that it's actually a subsidy. The other one is that you speak about an amount of 7.850 as the annual budget for this year, which we have own revenue at 5.5 million and the subsidy of 4.5, which is equal to 10 million. So I'm asking the question, the 7.850, why is that reflected when we are looking at 10 million? Why is that not been factored in to the budget discussion at the beginning? Or footnotes put in so that we can understand the amount of money? The other one which is also not factored in is we're speaking about Ezekiel. Has that conclusion been reached? That the 1 million that they get from takings on tickets, that it will actually now revert to the castle and it won't be considered leakage where they're not contributing? If that is the case, the castle also says that, yes, that is a third of the income, which means if they get 1 million, then the castle actually gets 2 million, because it's a third of their income. If they get it together, it means that they will be, just on the intake of the ticketing, will be 3 million. That is only on ticketing. The other one is that there's a number of commercial events that take place where people hire out the venue, and when they sign that agreement to pay a certain amount for using the venue, it is also known that the CCB does not provide any gatekeeping where they actually control the number of people coming in and out of the gate. People come in, they've got an arrangement, they've got an event taking place, so we don't actually know how many people actually use the castle. So is the reflection of 160,000 to 165,000 visitors to the castle, is that considered an accurate figure? If events are not actually monitoring the number of people actually coming into the castle. The other one, of course, as we move on, Honorable Chair, the amendments to the castle management, I think we'll deal with that when it is tabled, and we'll look at the merits of that. At this moment, it has been forwarded. The Minister will have to consider and then forward it to our committee. So I'm not going to comment on that. The issue of the control of the entire precinct, we know that, of course, the control doesn't mean then that the CCB takes full control, and there's a service level agreement with the DOD, with the DMV, and with the Zico and others that are using that space. Is that the case? And if head buckets is transferred, of course we're talking about the mess, the officers' mess as well. All that money then comes to the CCB. And if they are considered to be tenants and using the facility, would they be required to pay rental for using a part of the facility? The agreement is, of course, with the Center for Learning, Memory and Healing, is that DNB has made a contribution of about 3.5 million towards the center. Is there a service level agreement? It's only said and informed, we were informed, that military veterans can use the facility gratis, mahala. Is there a formal agreement in place that actually says that? And what times will it be available? Or is it available at all times? It may clash with other events that are also booking out the facility. So the SLA is supposed to clarify that position. So we have an issue here. That is still installed. It's not completed, the whole process. So I'd like to know if those matters have been taken into consideration in the negotiation process. The issue of the safety and security, I've noticed there's been an improvement. More guards have been appointed, and we appreciate that very much. But also we've heard the reports that some of the, because the reserves are taken, that come in there and they sent away, another batch come, and then a while later, 6 months, they come back again. Have those guys that have been problematic been removed? Because familiarity breeds contempt. We have a problem with it. And people do things because they're familiar with the environment, they commit offenses, and they wait for 6 months again. We'll see them again in 6 months. The issue is, does the DO take responsibility to remove those individuals that give a bad image to the castle? I'd like to know that. The other one is, of course, an ill discipline that people have been found drinking. I'm very happy to hear that that has not happened for a long while, but that was reported. It was in the media as well. The other one is the finding a treasury. Just the issue needs to be clarified for our purposes. Finding a treasury-approved solution to the funding of the day-to-day preventative maintenance. Now, day-to-day preventative maintenance is really a contradiction in terms. Preventative is normally where you plan ahead and you prevent it from happening and occurring. If you say day-to-day, it speaks to emergency matters. But nonetheless, if you said like that, given that the last appendix, page 97 of the APP, also refers to 4.5 million being allocated annually for emergency, for preventative, and for planned maintenance programs. So can I have some clarity, what is the CLOG allocated the 4.5 for? Or is this a separate 4.5 that we are speaking about? Then of course we'll get the report on the head buckets. We know that has been stored, but it's different negotiation with different parties. Similarly with Ezeko as well, there has to be negotiations. It's a long-standing arrangement. And if they terminate that, would they continue to operate there? And how would they operate? Are they expected to pay a rental? Or currently, what is the situation with Ezeko? The other one is, which I've been phoned several times by the museum that is closed down, the military museum. Officially, it has closed down by the end of April. Now, in the APP, it's indicated that the military museum will be absorbed into the CCB. Is that the case? What's going to happen to that military museum that existed there for ages, has been there for very long? And are we going to use that and enhance the museum, that if it's incorporated with the CCB, we need to have some clarity where it's going? Because it adds value, and one can actually add on to the current museum more value. So after it's closed down, we actually got no report. I did report the matter to the minister and to the SecDef, and I asked them what is in mind immediately after it closes at the end of April. So we haven't got any final answer on that. Also regarding, I spoke about the SLA, of course, between the DNB and the CCB. The acting DG didn't give me a clear answer, but maybe the CEO of the CCB will give me an answer of, does there exist now an SLA because of the money that was basically invested to enhance the facility and to make a conference center also available to military veterans. The other one is what is initiated in 2016 but temporarily delayed regarding the military veteran skills training initiative. Can we just get an idea of what the castle actually planned, and it was delayed, and they were intending to assist the military veteran skills training? I do know that part of the Defense Works Commission has come in to assist with building, etc. Did the castle actually contribute to help with the skills development of those military veterans to actually do those tasks, which is to do basically with maintenance and basic, not the major developments of the facility, the simple maintenance that they normally do, and improvement of the buildings. Also, I'd like to know, is there a level of cooperation between the CCB and the Khoisan Legislative Council in the Western Cape? The Khoisan has been using the facility extensively. They even put up their tents, and the tents were put on the outside. When I came to visit, it was actually on the outside of the building. And I believe there's a contract that has gone out for another koi tent to be built, or hut to be built. So what has happened, what is the relationship between the Khoi Legislative Council, those who are using the CCB, and particularly regarding the procurement of that particular item? How many military vets have been employed today, and in which capacity are the short-term, medium-term, long-term, or is it just a simple contract? Are they considered to be also permanent employees, or are they considered just contract workers? Because that was reported also in the HR to us that there will be three military vets that will be employed on a permanent basis. I just want to know, in previous years, before these people were employed, there was a clear indication of military vets being employed at the castle as well. And of course, we see the space is contested. I think the CEO has mentioned that. So is that which interest groups are claiming the castle as also their space, their contested space? Can we have some clarity which specific group or groups that are actually contesting? Then I want to move on quickly, Honourable Chair, to the comment made also in the APP for a more conservative curatorial philosophies and approaches of our partners. I'm very simplistic. So I'd like to know, what does this really mean? What's the implication of that sentence or phrase that is being used? Also, a similar statement is made that the increased focus on the castle attracts unsavory attention, compromising the safety and security of visitors and staff. Is this particularly now referring to all the events taking place, commercial events and things there? So that attracts actually unsavory attention, meaning there are elements in the community or what do you call them, Bergies and other people coming close because of all the activity taking place. Just to be a bit more specific, what is unsavory attention? What do we mean by that? And compromising. I know compromising the safety if people come into the castle and other people are there. However, we have security. We've got guards. We've got soldiers that are guarding the entrances. And how does one allow people to come into the castle? And how does one control that? If it's an event taking place, are there any controls in place? If I say I'm coming to attend an event, how does the guard know I'm coming to attend that event and that I'm actually paid for it or I'm actually invited guest or not? How do we do that? How do we control that gate? If we don't control it, it means an element gets in, pickpocketing can take place, which you must mention, or other things can happen on the facility. So that is another concern. The other one is, how is the security of staff and assets being threatened, and how is staff being affected by the unsavory? So we're asking the question, if the controls are there, how are they actually threatened? If they are threatened, is it from the people themselves? Because apparently there were some incidents in the past where some guys were drunk and they responded, of course, in a very negative way. And those reports were recorded with military police that were on the premise. There was also abuse also of events where people actually performed acts of sex on the facility and condoms were lying all over, which a number of the staff actually witnessed. So how does one set an agreement in place when you commercialize it? How do you control it? How do you don't allow people to do things on a military cultural precinct, which of course is the honor of military, of soldiers? That is why it is there. And that's why it has always been under DOD, because it holds a certain status in the sight of soldiers and military veterans. And we allow commercial events to take place to actually undermine that very image that we want to paint of a castle of dignity, a castle of honor that we want to put into public eye. Honorable Chair, I want you to continue then with the other one, which is responsible commercialization study. After we got our income, and we've got our subsidy, it suffices then to run the castle. Yet we have a responsible commercialization study. We have also a revenue optimization strategy and plan. Now, that plan has been coming on since I've been in the committee now a few years, and I think that is since that was part of the objectives that the CEO has made when he joined the council, to say that there's an optimization plan that will be achieved, that since 2013. I said, fine, let us get the plan going. What actually, up till today, we have not actually seen the revenue optimization plan and strategy and the other sources of revenue, or is it just the existing revenue that will be increased, or are there other avenues that's been exploited in that regard? So responsible commercialization study, where is that? Where is the optimization, revenue optimization plan, where is that? And then of course, there's also the DOD funded integrated conservation management plan, which is coming also on for the last 4 years. That conservation plan we actually asked for, which is important, because the whole castle has become and is planned to be a heritage site, an international heritage site, which means that particular document, strategy, policy and plan is absolutely essential to maintain that heritage site in that position, in that situation, that it's always clean and neat and not in a deterioration state. Okay. The issue is also that you see the castle indicated they are fully staffed, and that they feel they can deliver on the CCB's full mandate. Okay, so we acknowledge that. However, it says there is a position of the financial manager still open. Now, I know that Mr. Derek Williams is acting as bookkeeper at this site, and he's also secretary of the board. Now, we have a CFO, and the CFO is acting in a part-time position. What is exactly expected of a financial manager? Is it the same position? But I do know Mr. Williams is doing bookkeeping work at the council as well. Then the issue of Mr. Williams also serving as a bookkeeper, which is at the council, but he's also the secretary of the board. In terms of the agreement with the CEO, the CEO is the secretary of the board. So what arrangements have been made with the board that somebody else and not the CEO? The CEO normally, like the principal in the SGB position, becomes the secretary of the SGB in an ex officio capacity, because the person can inform the board of anything that happens at the castle. All development, all planning, all arrangements is the head of all affairs. Okay. Then I have also the issue, there's 89 direct employment opportunities that has been created and 300 temporary opportunities. I just like to have clarity how that is actually calculated, how is that determined. Then of course we see that these learnerships that have also been changed, it was 17, it has now been reduced to 15. In previous years it was 25, it was 30, it was 26. Why has it been changed to 15? And also, concerning these learnerships, are these individuals that have they exceeded, some of them exceeded the normal period of learnership? Is the learnership a 1 year, 1.5 year? And are those people that have actually exceeded, are they still considered to be part of a learnership, or are they permanent employees of the institution? And I know there is one person that basically works there that was on a learnership before, and that person now works there, and like to know the status of that individual that continues to work there that started off on the learnership. Then of course we have the very important one, which is strategic research capability. And I think this is for DOD, similarly for the CCCB, which is important, that we have R&D all the time, and that we keep abreast of affairs and how we can address our developments and issues as we continue into the future. I'd like to know what kind of products are being looked at by the research capability and that team, if that is envisaged, and what value is intended to add to the castle. I think we just have to have a clear plan, what is the strategy and plan for that research capability that we want to develop, and I believe that is a very important component of the castle. Then of course the issue of fraud and corruption, we'd like to know from the castle, has there been any cases of fraud and corruption, and also theft at the castle. And then also specifically to the military, to the soldiers that are guarding, has there been any cases opened up against any of our guards or reserves that are standing there of any fraud, corruption or theft? I'd like to have clarity also on the new innovative displays. There are five that has been earmarked here, targets. What does it entail? The new innovative displays. What are the five? Then, of course, I normally have a problem if there's some corroboration of that the number that we have an increase in media audience from 30 million to 60 million. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying who does that assessment and where is that coming from? Can we just have some verification? Because it's a 100% increase in that. And if it's a 100% increase, has other media been also utilized to actually increase the number of the media audience from 30 million to 60 million? There's no indication. So we have a baseline where we've used certain media, and if you want to increase that, either that media has expanded or you have to add new media to add more numbers to that particular audience. Then, of course, a concern here, no target has been set for the year-on-year increases in gross revenue generated by the CGH. So if there's no target being set, but there is an optimization plan, revenue optimization, there's also the other plan that we spoke about. So I'd like to know, have those things really been put down on paper, and has thought been put behind it to actually forecast what other income will be generated, and if that can be put as a target? So we know what the own revenue currently is, we know the subsidy that's coming in, we know that the Ezeco one that we could get money from, and then of course, can we get the rest of it? What is planned in that regard? The number of students, learners, or student intern and learners successfully supported, does it relate to the 40,000? If it does not, just to give us some clarity, I know the 15 interns, but the 40,000 that will increase to 45,000, just some more, just clarity on the matter.
An opportunity to respond to most of your questions,
Honorable
Issaf, because I see the time is
I just want to just a last point. Let's get the last point, and then I'm sure we can write the others. There shouldn't be a problem. The last one is, and we've spoken about this, Chair, before. When we set an APP, we set targets, we do an MTF. When I come back the next year, I get the annual report speaking back 1 year. Then I'd like to see the APP target that was set reflected again in the AR, in the annual report. Here there's been a wholesale changes of targets and figures and numbers, and that is not allowed. One has to be consistent even if you make changes. You're not allowed to go back what is already recorded as previous APP target that was set. You need to be clear on what has happened. So there's been changes made to previous year's target that was set. And even last year's target that was set for this year were changed. And then we've got a whole lot of numbers that I can quote. So the expenditure estimates, we have that. The targets, we have that. That's all there that has been changed. And this is a serious issue for us, Chair, because it's not being honest. We set targets because we have planned and we put our mind to it. And then the next year we come back and we change what has happened in the past, and we simply then add the different numbers. It does not give a good reflection on the department. So I've got a serious concern about all those targets and estimates that were changed. And we need an explanation for that. That's the point the rest I will do in writing. Thank you very much, sir.
Over to yourself, CCB. Just quick, some other comments that will help you going forward. And there are questions that need clarity to be answered through that.
Thank you, Honourable Issa. I'll just start with the maintenance issue and the 4.5 million. That 4.5 million is ring-fenced within the DoD infrastructure budget. So it's not allocated to the CCB. They don't manage it. They merely give us their requirements, and then it goes through the normal process where we approve, etc. We've also prepared a guideline document, and it's attached in the APP, where we actually categorize the different types of maintenance and refurbishment. So we do have the categories of emergency day-to-day maintenance, and that I'm not going to go into detail, the planned and preventative maintenance, and then the corrective maintenance. Okay. So So everything is there, according to me. Okay, fine. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you again, honourable members, for those to-the-point questions, and it shows the details with which the APP was combed through for these issues. I will respond. I think your last point, I think, is very important. I take it very serious. And if you can present that to me, then I will, if you talk about the changing of targets. I know that Manda will speak about the revenue adjustments that they have to make with Treasury, with the Movement Treasury and the AG. So we can give you that in the rationale for that. But all the targets are based on the five-year strategic plan and then the MT medium-term expenditure framework. If there are adjustments, like in the case of the number of interns, we provide an explanation to Treasury why we do that. So there's paperwork to if there are any justification. And we agree with you, we can't go back and change targets. So, but if you have details for me, we'll do that. For instance, honourable members, we're talking about that there's no revenue target. Or are you talking about the percentage, the increment increase? Because there is a revenue target of 7.85 that matches our expenses. It's on page 39 and 47. It's in the APP. So I'm not sure if you talk about the percentage change, honourable member, or whether you talk about the quantum. You talk about the quantum. It's 7.85 because we are not allowed to under budget or over budget. So what you see as revenue is also what the expenses are of the organisation. Those 7.85. Then the Iziko deal. The reason why we don't want to commit on paper what the arrangement with Iziko is. Let me say sub judice if it was the case, but we are both public entities. We can't talk about sub judice. But there is a process where the Iziko executive met with our management, where we went through the issues and where we tried to get to a better rationale as the one-third, because there was no rationale for the one-third. It was Samsung. Iziko managed the William Fair collection. That was the middle part. What is that part? The F-block, no? Yeah. F-block. And I think roughly 10 or 15 years ago, they thought that is a third of the castle, and they could use that as the basis for that. We are challenging, the board is challenging that. We have met them, and in December, they seem to understand it, but then they stalled because the CEO of Iziko is also on our board, explained that why they couldn't go forward with that. She lost, like, three senior managers, and that process was stalled. So we couldn't, in the APP, already report that there's progress in terms of that. But we are pursuing this matter. So the limit that we're talking about is not there yet. It's not that the income is coming to us, but the idea is that it should come to us and that there should be a scientific rationale what we pay to Iziko in terms of a service that they deliver to the public. Because it's about the public. What are they delivering? Is the William Fair collection really R1 million worth or not? And they seem to agree that it's not, but there's a task team that's looking at a better basis to calculate that. Then commercial events. If I look at this weekend's event, web tickets or compu tickets, there are many of these ticketing organizations through which people are purchasing these tickets to these events, so they normally send us the report. They send us a physical report, and on that basis, then we have a scientific basis to do that. There is, however, a smaller problem on open days, on Heritage Day and on Emancipation Day, when we are free. Then what we do, we put the interns at the gate, they do a headcount in terms of 10, and those 10 people are then rung up at the till as a zero, and those figures then are our auditable figures to get our figure of 165,000 per day. So there are enough, I think there's enough processes in the absence of a pure barometric access point where you can count people in and out, enough auditable records for us to say that those figures are as close to accurate as we can get. Control of the entire precinct, I think it was on my slide, I've said what is the progress in terms of that, so I won't go into that. The center of memory and it's not 3.9 million, it's 4.9 million, the contribution of the DMV to this. The DMV, as the hold up chairperson and honorable member, is that the DMV needs to sign off completely with the service provider, where they take, you know, the center. This center needs then to be capitalized as part of the overall DoD's, you know, before that happened, before the SF is not capitalized, all of those things have not happened. The current SLA between the DMV and the CCB, where we acted as the agency for, to oversee the implementation of the project, is still valid. But we need a management agreement between us and the DMV to manage that center for them in future. That will include giving access to military veterans, to the, like, yes, for the past 3 days, the military also has an event in that in a conference room. There are private people, so that we manage that in a proper manner. But we need to have the DMV almost assign us to do that formally. In the meantime, we have an informal agreement that we do that. Then the safety and security, I think you've spoken to that. Colonel Fenny, maybe we can speak. I think the guards, my knowledge is that the guards who transgress are not redeployed at the site anymore, but I will leave Colonel Fenny to later speak about that, or he can answer now.
Thanks, Chair. Honourable Member. The guards that become indisciplined whilst they are on duty, they are charged through the normal processes, and depending on the outcome of the case, whether one was guilty or not. And if one has been, found guilty, and then that individual will not be called up again for that particular, duties. And to be quite specific on your question, right now, yes, I am aware that there were disciplinary actions that were taken, but frankly speaking, I don't have now that accurate answer whether indeed he was discharged or what were the sentence. But it's something that one can, follow up. Thanks.
Then quickly, my English, we are both Afrikaans speaking, so let me try to this one. The Treasury approved solution. What we are saying, and it's the same 4.5 that we're speaking, because the budget, the overall budget for the CCB is so low, a 4.5 represents quite a significant contribution, indirectly or directly. So Treasury approved means we're engaging the relevant Treasury officials to say what is it in terms of the PFMA that they require from us to make this to legitimize this process, both from a DoD or CLOC and from a CC point point of view. It's the same if we get a appeal for sponsorship. We normally go to Treasury and ask them to give us the permission to do that. The same with the surplus. Although, the surplus is relatively, the last surplus, 2.2, is relatively low, we always go back to Treasury to do that. That's what we mean by Treasury-approved solution. But the 4.5 is no, it's the same 4.5 that that my board member has spoken about. I've spoken about the Zico. The military museum, let me kill that myth. The military museum is not closing because it's a DoD asset. The Castle Military Museum Foundation, a trust, is winding down and they are closing down. And they were like friends of the museum, type of researchers. What did they do? They would hold cheese and wine functions there and whatever. So they engaged me and they say they became too old. They don't have the appetite to call these meetings of the trust anymore. So they will disband the trust in terms of the court, master of the court. So it's them that's disbanding. They can't close the military museum. So the military museum is continuing despite the fact that they are disbanding. It's a valuable human resource that we're losing. But I think we can go out and call a friends of the museum initiative together again. They were old professors and academics, yeah, and maybe they feel that the contribution is not, is relevant anymore, so they're disbanding the trust there. But we will keep you updated how that process is going, Chairperson, through you, and honorable members. The military veterans, and it's not military veterans training to look after the site. It was to select military veterans to participate in a program to train them in management of logistics and management of sites like the castle. So it was not about how them to make them security guards or whatever, but it is to look for that. And this was another joint project between the DMV and the castle control board, like the conference center. But that process is stalled because they couldn't identify the relevant role players. The DMV is also saying that this project is not viable anymore, etc. So that is linked to another question about then the service provider, is called Efotech, then sued us because they say we broke the contract. But they didn't sue us for the complete contract, only for the work already done. But now our lawyers have since engaged them, and they want to settle now because I think there's now a second year. Yeah, it's an issue on the board for every year. Every year it comes up. So they were coming to settle in exchange for whatever they've produced so far. So I think they want to walk away from the contract. We want to walk away from the contract and this. And if the DMB feels in future they want to re-advertise for this contract and continue, they can. I think they should do so in future. Yeah. They were wrong. Our lawyers argue that they're suing the board wrongfully. Because we're not the funder, we're the agent. They're suing the board, but they're saying it's rightfully, we say it's wrongfully, and I think they realize now probably that they're making a mistake and they want to settle out of court now. Yes. So that's where, but I'll keep the committee updated on how that case is developing. The Khoisan Legislative Council is not the only organization that we're working with. We work with Controleurs in the Western Cape. We work with the Royal Houses, the Griqua Royal House. We work with all of them, and I think at the December board meeting, the chairperson was very adamant that we bring them closer instead of having them outside, because it's very difficult to contain and manage a public image if they're outside. So yes, they have the every, Azola must help me, every second week they meet. Every second week they meet in the castle. They have the meetings there. They have events there. So we say outdoors that our doors are open, and they play a meaningful role in the curatorial philosophy that you were talking about, which is progressive, which is inclusive, which is educational. It just means that instead of just purchasing artifacts and putting it away in a boardroom or in a workshop or there behind in your storeroom, we're saying bring it out. Let's let the people engage with this. That's what we mean by a progressive, more inclusive curatorial philosophy. So to answer that question also. So it's not the traditional preserve and conserve. It is educate, reach out, involve people, speak to people. And that's where we have the slogan, taking the castle to the people and bringing the people to the castle. So that's the philosophy. And in my trip now, 2 months ago in Sri Lanka, that approach, in fact, they engaged us. How can we assist them to also, in the Gulf Fort, have a more inclusive process, to have the less fortunate communities that cannot afford to get to their castle also to that. So we're sharing information around that. So we just mean it's more open-minded, it's more progressive, and it's more inclusive, and it's more educational. And many of the other organizations do not have that, Jefferson. As much as you think we have 24 years in our democracy, many people have not, in a museum environment, haven't internalized that. Military veterans, there are 3 military veterans benefiting at this current moment, and they are precinct officers. They are part-time, they have short-term contracts, and their contracts have just been renewed for another year to answer that particular question. I've spoken about contested space in the curatorial philosophy. The increase, I think a lot of questions was around this, attracting through events and open days, attracting unsavory elements into the castle. Your unsavory elements can easily pass the guards because they will pay the 200 rand. Smartly clothes, better clothes than me, because they know if they get a Samsung cell phone, minus Note 5, if they have the Samsung, their investment would be worthwhile. If there are 2,000 people at an event, or at Heritage Day, up to 10,000 people at the event, they will slip in and will go there. We normally brief the guards, we brief the security, the precinct officers before the time, but we can't regulate people's behavior. We can do whatever we want, we can put all the guards there, but we can't regulate that. The same question around your question around MCQP, and we can't, if people come to an event, we can't regulate their sexual behavior or what they do. We can police it as far as possible, we can sensitize the guards, etc., but we can't do. But in this case, Chairperson, I don't know about this incident, but at least there was safe sex practice on a very lighter note, but we can't. We can't really regulate people. They come there, they pay for an event, whether it's a free event or heritage event or commercial event, but in that price, there's no when you're there. We will brief police intelligence, we will brief people, but these things slip in. We can say, okay, let's then, and we have had a think tank. Maybe we need to, with the city of Cape Town and the SEPS Central, have then a risk, you know, where we have a green event, orange event, red event, and maybe we should sit down and say certain events are too high risk for the image of the castle, which we agree with, honorable members, and then avoid those. In terms of the constitution, I don't know how we're going to say no to them, but maybe we will, you know, in our event, in our evolving events policy, maybe to put in some of those indicators that's prohibitive, or it spells out that some of these events are not compatible with the image of such a heritage site. Commercialization event response. I've spoken about this. The responsible commercialization and revenue optimization plan is one document. It's a study that the board conducted 3 years ago. And I think I must make physical printouts and give it to the members. And in there's a section, how do you optimize the revenue? It's four-legged. Event is one of them. Gate taking is one of them. The restaurant is one of them. The conference center now is one of them. And also, leasing, you know what do you call this? Office leasing of space for organizations. But that one, the board is put on hold. Because once you open that and you start to be a landlord, you just get into a very murky territory. Because then there are rules at the castle. For instance, 5 o'clock the castle gates open, but maybe this tenant wants to still trade till 7 o'clock in the evening. It's just very difficult for us to do that. So we're refining that part. And deal with it. So maybe the waterblomiki outside of the castle is easier to do, but inside we have a difficulty of that particular act. So there are legs of this responsible commercialization strategy that includes revenue optimization for that matter. Then the question of the financial manager. I think there's some confusion in the organogram, the CFO position is listed as financial manager. The CFO, the current CFO, Mandla Ngewu, sitting behind me, is responsible for both the financial management and is fulfilling the role in terms of the PFMA as the CFO. So it's a collapsing. I agree with you that the board secretary, who is also the, accountant, bookkeeper, is maybe overburdened, and we need to take that position over and separate that. But I think in terms of that, what we need is perhaps something more junior to do this, to be in between. But I think we are in terms of that, that's maybe a miscommunication in the organogram. But the CFO position and the financial manager is collapsed. That the CFO is a role that's fulfilled in terms of the PFMA, because that was always a query of this committee, that there's no CFO, there's no CEO. And so that one has been dealt with. Then the employment, what we do, like for instance in the Ramadan for All event, the events organizer, when they apply for the event, they need to tell us how many security guards will be employed there, how many precinct officers, how many. So they give us, as part of the proposal, they give us figures. And on the basis of that, annually, we can calculate how many indirect is jobs have been created and job opportunities have been created in terms of events. Most of these will be created around events. It is a understated figure, because we have an average about 45 commercial events per year, and we will get us a analyst to even do it more accurately. But this is what we get back from the events organizers in terms of the temporary job opportunities that they create at the venue. The more temporary jobs is for repeat. There are many repeat events. People who have 3-4 events in a year. So the 89 is based on those more repeat events and direct employment opportunities that we have at the castle. But I'm studying community in the board. That is vastly underestimated. It should be much higher than this. Then the learnership, I've explained the learnership position. I'm almost there, Chairperson. The strategic research, this is research that we do on the basis of our feedback from our clients in terms of when we do papers at international conferences, then we have the research. We can certainly make that available, because I think if there's internationally people are impressed with what we're doing, certainly we should also excite you and other local people for what we're doing. And the lady next to me, for instance, has completed a master's degree research on a comparison between the fort in Ghana and the castle of Gulu. So we can disseminate that. We will put it on our website also for people to access. We will do that, yeah. Fraud and corruption cases, just two, and it's involve one individual, and there are, I don't want to talk about that because there are sub judice. So maybe in October month these cases will be concluded, and then we will give you a feedback on that. But you are welcome, Chairperson and members, to ask me for update on that before it. Both of them are still pending. The cases against the guards has been especially innovative, five innovative displays. I think we've mentioned the one, the one that's going out for the Khoisan Valleys. We have had the Kratoa bends. So it's all of the kind of new elements that we try to interpret the castle in a more inclusive way to all the layers, the slave layer, the colonial layer. So it's innovative, because it's never been done at the castle before. So so the target has been set. It's a tight target, because you don't always have money for this, but we are happy that through Azola, with his experience at Ezekiel and Sarah, we'll be able also to get us partners to make sure that we sustain the number of innovative displays at the castle.
I think we must just park it there.
We'll park it there.
Questions?
The 40,000 has got nothing to do. It's the number of learners that book to come and have tours at the castle. So it's nothing to do with the learnerships and internship of the 15 that came down from 15 to 30. This is just a target. See how many learners do we also get through the schools and students. And then I've spoken about the revenue. We have set the revenue target. And then the media target, it was unambitious. So we stretched our marketing manager to put that higher, because the 350 commemoration has really put us there, and we want to sustain that high level of media audience that we reach. Because the more people we reach through media, the more people will eventually translate in coming through the gates. Thank you. ICMP, you can talk. Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. That's my part.
Thank you, sir. The ICMP, we appointed the tenderer in January. We've already had two meetings, and we've given them 2 years, but they will most definitely complete that before the 2 years is over.
Yeah, people, the companies that come or the organizations that use the facility, they bring their own security and they bring their own people to manage their event. Now, in the event of that, I want to ask, so there are present those people that are guards and actually looking at the event that's taking place and where wrong things are happening, and they have guards there. Other one is, it's a public facility, it's a military facility. Do we have surveillance cameras inside the grounds of the castle? If so, there's a precinct officer that is on duty at all times when events take place at the precinct. Does that person have a screen to actually monitor what's happening on the grounds? If so, there will be footage to pursue those individuals and to prosecute them, because it's public indecency that's taking place.
In, in case you don't have that, you must take this as a as an advice, as a security advice. From what you see, I see you don't have that.
We are outside cameras, was it big and newfoundland, and in the museums itself. But the cameras that was facing the courtyard has been, let me put it, destroyed during the renovation. So there's a tender out part of this 4.5 million that will replace those cameras.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we are taking a presentation or a briefing from the OBAT tomorrow at 2. Yeah, in the Max building, eh? Room 314. Yeah. Thank you very much, Castle Control Board, Kalpil Kalbin, and your staff delegation.
What's not the other one? The other one.
Yeah.
Okay.